All right, is everybody back? Excellent. Nope, one more person.
That was a foliage here.
Yeah, and you can also like, it would get like.
It's from there, right?
Oh, we could just.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, we have a really cool opportunity here. I get to introduce Philip Schuster and Natalia Toro. They are two of our particle physics researchers. Like I've said, a lot of researchers don't really like to be pinned down to one group. You're pretty happy with the particle physics part, because you guys, that's what you do. But yeah, exactly. Everything's made of particles, there you go. They're gonna talk to you a little bit maybe about their path that brought them here. Your job is to ask really good, insightful questions, to learn about what it's like to be a physicist. And they've allowed me to also mention this. They are married. So you can actually, you can, romance. Okay. We actually have had researchers get married here who met, but they didn't. They came together as a pair. That also gives you a little bit of something else that you can ask. You can ask a little bit more about life outside of this building. What is it like to be a couple doing research as well? And what are some of the challenges that they know of, that sort of thing? Okay? And so I'm going to turn it over to them. They have way better things to tell you than I do. So let's give them a welcome.
Introducing ourselves and telling you a little bit about what we do. So I'm Natalia. I grew up in Colorado, to become Boulder. Came up here to PI 4 years ago after doing grad school and one postdoc. So I'm starting to get to know Waterloo. I sort of feel at home here. In terms of physics, I work on a lot of, I said sort of as a joke, everything is particle physics, but there's really truth to it in the sense that everything in the universe is made of particles, and every question we have about the fundamental structure of nature, that is at least everything that we've figured out how to test directly, we can really frame in terms of thinking about how different kinds of particles interact. So one thing that I've worked on is thinking about particle physics, the sort of very traditional idea of particle physics, is big experiments like the Large Hadron Collider. You have two really high energy bunches of protons, smash them into each other and see what kinds of particles come out. And you can try to use that to figure out what kind of physics is going on at really short distances in nature. So that's one question that's definitely particle physics. But another thing that I do that's also particle physics is asking questions about really long distance physics. Can we use this sort of particle structure of nature that we've seen all around us and tested in many ways to figure out what the most general options are for physics at really large distances? Have we explored all the possibilities or not? And it turns out this idea that forces are related to particles. We have graviton's for gravity, photons for electromagnetism. This is really helpful in classifying what happens in really long distance physics. So we can actually figure out that there are kinds of particles without any mass that we haven't really made sense of yet. And the troubling thing about them is a different, not troubling, just the unfamiliar thing about them is a different kind of particle spin. And from there it gets technical, so I'll stop. But everything from really short distances to really long distances, from really theoretical stuff to more experiment, is sort of what I think about. And both of the specific things that I mentioned are things that I've worked pretty closely with and want to. So.
Yeah. So my name is Philip. Actually, everybody who knows me calls me Chris, but mostly Philip. So we're both particle physicists. I think. So yes, it's true, people don't like to be pegged into one area. I don't mind being called a particle physicist, though, because particle physicists get to have all the fun because we get to do basically anything and everything. So we collide particles because, so far as we can tell, it looks like nature is built out of particles. That's what we see coming out in our experiments. Sometimes we use the same kind of technology that quantum information people study for building quantum computers, except we try to use it to test fundamental physics, basic ideas of fundamental physics. Sometimes we just test quantum mechanics. Sometimes we want to use it to try to look for dark matter. So you guys went to Snow Lab recently, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm actually curious. They didn't fit you all in the...
We had two groups.
No,
okay. I'm trying to imagine, like, because when you open up, there's this big, like, wet tunnel that you have to go through. It's like a kilometer hike to get to the lab. So you guys can all go at once. Yeah, so that lab, as you know, so you probably heard all about things like dark matter. Maybe you heard a little bit about neutrinos, things like that. So we're in this kind of we're at this kind of weird stage right now. You know, so roughly a century ago, we had, like, you know, if you asked somebody what a table was built out of, they would come up with all sorts of ideas, or they had all sorts of answers for you, but we really didn't know. Okay? So, you know, that was a situation where most of the matter that was, like, directly in front of us, we couldn't identify in any careful, sort of controlled way. So clearly we've come a long way. But we're still actually in the same situation. At a sort of qualitative level, things haven't changed. Most of the matter that we know is there, we don't know what it is. It's not stuff in the tabletop anymore. Now it's just stuff that's out in the universe. But we're still in this situation where most of the substance in the universe, we just don't know what it is. We don't know how it works. And so that's where all of the that's where all the fun and exploration comes in. So like we've been doing for the last century, what we do is we try to come up with different ways of doing experiments to answer sort of yes or no. Is dark matter a particle that's heavy? Is it a particle that's light? Is it a particle that interacts, you know, through electromagnetism? Does it interact with a strong force? Does it interact with weak force? Is it something totally new? Is it big macroscopic objects? Just all over the place. So that's one thing we do. Another thing we do is there's all these unanswered questions about how nature works. So we have this, we have just with the stuff that we're built out of directly. So we have this beautiful theory that you may have heard about. People kind of give it an awful name. They call it the standard model. Okay, so it makes it sound very standard, very boring. It's one of the it's the most beautiful theory that we, beautiful may not be the, beautiful's in the eye of the beholder. It is the most comprehensive theory that we've ever constructed. It describes everything that we, you know, more or less can see and can manipulate at a practical level. But the theory itself has a number of holes. The theory itself doesn't explain dark matter, has problems with neutrinos. As you know, famously, it doesn't include quantum gravity. So there's all these missing pieces. So we're still in this situation where there's a lot of uncertainty, there's a lot of incompleteness to it, even though it's so complete that describing now, you know, what happens kind of at a local level. So that's what we do. We try to find ways of figuring out how to fill in these missing gaps, just like we've been doing for the last century. So what you saw at Snow Lab was part of that. So people there have a whole bunch of different experiments. So there's experiments there studying neutrinos, there's experiments studying dark matter. I know you didn't go to CERN. That would be a bit of a long field trip. But yeah, across the Atlantic in Geneva, so it sort of crosses over into France and Switzerland, there's the Large Hadron Collider. So this is the largest collider. In fact, this is the largest scientific project in human history, just full stop. So this thing is trying to understand how to complete the standard model. So one thing we don't fully understand is what the underlying sort of microscopic mechanism that generates mass is. A lot of mass we understand, so we roughly understand why protons and neutrons have mass. But if, for example, you ask the question, you know, why does an electron have mass? And of course, the mass of an electron in atoms is very important. Because if you took away that mass, atoms would just disappear. You wouldn't have any atoms in the world. Okay. So that's a process that that's a piece of physics that we're trying to understand with this huge collider. And as you may have heard about, we discovered the Higgs boson a couple of years ago, and so that's something that we're continuing to do. And then, as Natalia mentioned, there's all these mysteries at very, very long distances. So you may have heard about dark energy, which is another, there's dark matter, there's dark energy. So we give these very kind of, you know, no information names to things we don't fully understand.
Because we have no information about.
Because we have no direct information. That's not to say we don't have ideas. We have actually a lot of very good ideas, I think very good ideas for what some of these things are. But it's very hard to sort of experimentally check and confirm that what you think might be happening is actually happening.
Yeah, Yeah, not very hard, like, give up and go think about something else. No, very hard, like, it just has taken decades to get the experiments off the ground. And a lot of what you saw at Snow Lab is experiments looking for some of these good ideas of dark matter. There's other experiments on the way. So, yeah, very hard doesn't mean disconnected from experimental tests. It just means that it's a time-consuming process.
So we're both happy to talk more about the physics, but so... Well, you mentioned where you grew up. So I grew up in Oregon City, Oregon, so on the West Coast, and then I lived for 8 years in Boston, and then we lived 3 years in California, and then we came up here. We've been here for the last 4 years. So I have no sense for, yeah.
I forgot to mention one other thing about these two that make them special as theorists, is they are deeply collaborative with experimental science, especially the CMS and some other accelerators.
Well, this is something else that particle physicists get to do if they want to. So because we're in the business of coming up with ideas, testing them, figuring out how things work, using whatever technology, whatever ideas we can come up with, a bunch of us, especially a lot of us here, not just the two of us, we have other theorists here at PI who are particle physicists who also think about experiments. So we have a couple of experiments of our own at Jefferson Lab, where we've in the past been very heavily involved in one of the big experiments at the Large Hadron Collider. So that's been a great deal of fun. So it's true we do both theory and we do experiment, but we are, you know, we're definitely trained as theorists.
Yeah, but that's one of the things you could ask them about is sort of we've already been exploring that difference between theory and experiment. These two have a good insight into both worlds.
So do we get to ask questions?
Let them ask questions.
I want to ask a couple of questions. So. Sorry. So where do people come from, broadly speaking? Maybe.
Miami.
Shut it out, guys. Where are you from?
Miami.
Thank you.
Greece.
England.
Ballpark.
York.
Israel.
Brazil.
Australia.
Awesome. Okay.
You're half Canadian, half international.
Okay. I heard some pretty interesting places there. All right. And so, do all of you want to become physicists, or are you, is this something you're thinking about, or? Maybe subjects related to physics, because of course everything uses physics in some way. But not sure. Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay. Yeah.
No, but for example, a bunch of us next year we will curse the degree of physics and mathematics. And a question that I want to ask you was. Mathematics, the degree of mathematics will help us to become physicists, or it will interfere with physics stuff?
Oh, I don't, look, mathematics is useful for so many things, including physics. So it's not possible to study mathematics too much at a very zeroth order level. But it depends on, you know, it depends on what suits you. It's true, you know, in some subjects you use a little bit of mathematics, and so, you know, if you study too much mathematics, maybe your time is spent. Better spent on something else. But in theoretical physics, of course, mathematics is something that will sort of, you know, the more math you know, roughly speaking, the easier it is to solve or address questions that you may have. Not always. There's sort of a combination of you know, in some sense, the hardest part about the theoretical side of physics is actually just taking a question you have about nature and making it precise enough. And that often means quantitative, making it precise and quantitative enough so that you can actually study it and figure out how to bring experiment to bear on the question. Okay. Now, some questions are purely theoretical and have nothing to do with experiments. There's just questions of consistency, you know, do different ideas fit together in a self-consistent way? And there, you know, mathematics is often extremely helpful. It's sort of the language we use. Now, if you want to do experiment, you know, there's more of a balance. It's, of course, very important to know plenty of mathematics, but you know, you may not need to understand the very abstract, sophisticated, cutting-edge mathematics to be a great experimentalist, right?
Yeah, I mean, go with your interests. Like, there are some people, I did a double major in math and physics. And I'd say a lot of the, I mean, obviously the sort of mathematics through, like, linear algebra and basic group theory is stuff that you will use all the time as a physicist. If you're doing any kind of field theory, any kind of quantum mechanics, you will be using that. If you're doing something like general relativity, you'll be using Riemannian geometry a lot in differential geometry. If you're doing, you know, string theory, you might be using commutative algebra. Okay, now algebraic geometry. Now, I personally took, you know, lots of these classes, and most of it, with the exception of, like, you know, I took functions of multiple complex variables. I use functions of one complex variable all the time in physics, and I have never personally used functions of multiple complex variables. Okay, but I think if you're excited about it, it's good to learn it, and the process of the sort of abstract, the kind of abstract thinking that you need for math, I think it's good practice for the kind of abstract thinking you need in physics, which is different, but not altogether unrelated. On the other hand, that's not to say, you know, if you're one of these people that's really interested in circuits or in computer code or in chemistry or whatever else related subject, you know, pursue that instead of math as your sort of side interest. And there will be other areas of physics where it is much more useful than the higher math. So it just depends on what your interests are and what, you know, if you do what you're excited about, that's going to take you pretty much roughly where you want to be.
Well, I've kind of like gotten a sense that like everyone kind of really can only dedicate their entire career to a couple of theories. So how do you really go about choosing what you want to study for such a long period of time when there's so much to choose from?
Don't get stressed out about it. That's the best advice that I can give. So I've been a physicist of one kind or another, I guess. Like, I started grad school in 2003, so about 11 years. I've worked on three completely different areas already. Now, all sort of within particle physics. Like, I would have a hard time switching to, you know, applied physics for renewable energy or to astronomy or something like that. That would be a major career change. But I've worked on three completely different problems during those 10 years. And, you know, I hope to work on many, many more during the rest of my time. So, you know,
depends on your taste.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can work really hard on a problem, you make some progress, and then you just, you know, you just get bored with the problem.
Yeah.
And you want to work on something else. Some problems feel like they're more amenable to making, you know, making progress on them now, and so you'll switch and you work on those. So it all depends. There are some people who will work on one area for a very long time, in part because there's sort of steady progress being made in that subject, and they you know, it really suits them, you know, gets under their skin, and they just keep at it.
Yeah, mainly people are doing that because they're really excited about that problem, and they really want to keep going. Or you're afraid to take chances and risks, which is a bad reason to stay on one problem. But, I mean, if you're doing it because you feel like you can't switch, because that would require learning something new, well, you know, learning something new is something we try to do every day. So you should not, that's probably the wrong attitude. But if you're, most of the people that you see working on a very sort of specific set of problems, it's because they're making a lot of progress and they're really excited about it.
Okay.
Okay. So what is like getting like the first lab failure and how do you get back up from that point?
Sorry, what's it? What? Sorry.
You know, if you have a theory and some other person like destroys your theory completely, how do you get back up from in your feet? How do you sound?
Well, you know, you feel like crap for a little while, and you get over it. it's like anything else, you know. Fortunately, if you're developing a theory and well, there's different kinds of failure, by the way. So in at least in physics. So the good thing about failure in physics is that usually when you fail, it's not like if you're a doctor and you fail, you know, it's a little different. Okay. So at least it's got that. But usually what it is, there's intellectual failures where you will literally just calculate the wrong answer. Right? There's those kinds of things. Those are the sorts of things where you just feel bad. You get over it, you figure out what you did wrong, you learn from it, That's the important thing, and then you just move on. Then there's other things, which are failures of a much more exciting type, which is you're not wrong at an intellectual level. You have an idea, you have a theory, you calculate things correctly, but the idea is just wrong in the sense that it doesn't apply to nature. Okay, and those it's fantastic.
That's great.
Yeah, that's actually great because then it's okay. I mean, the idea can be lame, it can be stupid. Okay, in the sense that it's sort of trivial. In which case, falsifying it isn't such a big deal. But especially when you have an idea that's, you know, a little bit subtle, a little bit interesting, and that's falsifying, that's always exciting. That's always good. You still feel a little bummed out about it, because it's always better to be right. But by the way, I mean that's another part of being part of physics, for example, that's fun. There's a sort of, you know, there's technical skills. There's knowing a lot of mathematics. There's knowing a lot about the subject. There's knowing a lot about technology that you can bring to bear on questions. But there's sort of a less technical but more of a kind of fine art to finding, you know, there's a very, very fine-tuned set of problems where the problems are, you know, amenable to analysis, you can make progress on them, and at the same time, they're amenable to experimental attack. Okay? And the overlap between things you can attack with experiment, things that you can actually understand with theory now, that is like a vanishingly small set of things. And it's very, very important to always find those things, and then because that's how you actually make progress. You're just chipping away right at that boundary. Okay. But anyway, and you fail all the time when you're doing that. So.
And you learn things from those failures, right? And I think because they are these sort of, you learn by asking questions, and you learn when you don't find anything. The community as a whole does not sort of trash people whose ideas turn out to be wrong. If you had an idea that was interesting, it was sort of intellectually new, it was consistent with all the data we had before, and then someone goes out and doesn't find it, that's a job well done. Obviously, that's not the thing you get, you know, you work towards hoping to find a theory that's going to be right, right? And you don't get Nobel Prizes for wrong theories either. But that's a kind of failure that is, first of all, ubiquitous. Okay, the only physicist you'll find who has made no wrong predictions and had no wrong ideas is the physicist who doesn't make predictions or have ideas. So, you're in good company when you fail that way. And, you know, and you keep going. And it means you have a knack for finding things that are at least possibilities, and when you test the possibilities, you've learned something new.
So usually I'll have this discussion with postdocs, who are, you know, sort of looking for advice. You know, they've gone through sort of various levels of their education, they've got all this knowledge, but then they're on their own, they're doing research, they're trying to get their feet on the ground. And they're trying to figure out how do they gauge, you know, whether they're making good progress, things like that. And it's very, very hard to gauge this. But failure is actually an important part of this, because if you're not failing regularly, in the sense that you're not coming up with ideas and then killing them, then something is wrong. And it's actually a good measure of how you're doing. Is, you know, if you're killing lots of ideas, you're coming up with lots of ideas that you yourself, you know, knock down, and then you move from one bad idea to the next with undiminished enthusiasm. I think this phrase goes back to Churchill, and, you know, many physicists like to keep this in mind. That's a sort of a good metric for seeing whether or not you're moving along as a researcher. Because if you're doing that, then invariably you do encounter something that's got some grain of truth that is really worth developing.
Well, out of curiosity, what graduate schools did you go to, and how much did your advisors affect the way you interpret or, like, deal with physics in your individual, like, areas?
Alright, so we both had the same advisor.
Oh, okay.
We met right before grad school, and we were both interested in very similar things. So we both worked with Nimar Fani-Hamed, who was at Harvard at the time. And, you know, it's funny. I'd say that the physics I do is extremely different from the kind of physics that he does. Actually, it was even to some extent while I was a graduate student. I was always sort of picking at problems that were on the periphery of what he was doing. But in many ways, I think his way of thinking about physics did have a huge impact on me. I think finding when you get to grad school, finding an advisor whose sort of way of thinking about the world you find energizing is really important, because you know you're going to have to be working with them for several years, and you want to be developing as an independent scientist, but you want to be developing that way in, you know, in the company of somebody that you actually want to work with and learn from.
What kind of progress have you seen in your own projects and stuff? Because you said you were doing some progress at the something lab, Jefferson Lab. Have you seen progress in your own projects?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So of course, the best kind of progress is you discover a brand new phenomenon, or, I mean, this is one example. There's many types of discoveries. You discover some brand new phenomenon that nobody else has seen that sort of sheds light on some long-standing question. So those happen every once in a while. Okay? And now, the kinds of progress actually, both of us work on some of these projects. We have these experiments at Jefferson Lab. Basically, what happened is several years back, we found some new ways of doing experiments, actually with technology that was developed, you know, a couple decades ago, but the sort of modern form of this technology. This is fixed target technology. But you can very, very powerfully look for new fundamental forces, and you can even look for dark matter directly using some of the techniques that we sort of reanalyzed and then applied in this new setting. And that's really come along quite a way. So now there's a bunch of experiments based on these ideas that have been built. They're going to be run. One of them is actually two of these experiments have already taken test run data, and they've shown that these methods work. And so now next year and the year after, hopefully the year after, but next year for sure, one of these experiments is really they're gonna get on the experimental floor, they're gonna take data for a prolonged period of time, and they have a real shot at discovering new fundamental forces. They really have a real shot. Now, most of these experiments, you know, there's the reality of it all. We do experiments in all sorts of fronts, and a lot of the time it doesn't pan out. But it's really exciting to do an experiment where you're just launching into this brand new territory that nobody's looked at, right? There's no other experiment that really has anything to say about the kind of physics that these experiments are going to do. So that's progress.
What is it like being in a graduate school or PhD course? Like, when does the division between theoretical physicist and experimental physicist happen? And do you automatically become a researcher if you finish your PhD?
Okay, good question. So I think it probably depends a little bit on the school, like when you switch from the experimentalist and theorist to separate. Usually in the first year, you're taking pretty much the same courses. Maybe if you're an experimentalist, you take a few extra electronics courses that theorists aren't taking, and if you're a theorist, maybe you take some of the more formal theory classes, if you think you want to be a theorist. But I know actually quite a few people who have switched back and forth around their first or second year of grad school. A few people even later. I'd say it's less common just because most people by that point usually have a sense of what they want to do. Already by the first year, it's a good idea to try to do some small projects with not necessarily, you know, somebody that you think you might want to work with, but it's not like you're making a big commitment with them. You do a little research project or a little reading project, and you get a sense of what what that aspect of physics is like. And that might make you decide, gee, I really hate doing theory, or I really hate doing experiment, or hopefully I really love doing this. And you sort of, you sort of find your way. Actually, if you get a chance to do a little bit of research either over the summer or during the semesters as an undergraduate, especially later on, sort of junior, senior year of undergraduate, it's a really useful experience and something I highly recommend to you guys. So it doesn't have to start. You can even start as an undergraduate, although I think the experiences you have as an undergraduate or as a graduate student doing research are very good. Now, for your second question, well, do you have anything to add? Okay, do you want to take the second one? Or should I? Have you forgotten what it is?
I have a short one.
Okay, I'll answer that. So the second question was basically, after you get your PhD, are you automatically a researcher? So do you So after you get your PhD, you have a lot of options for what you want to do next in your life.
Yeah, a lot of people do something totally
different. I know, one of our, our good friend from grad school knew already by a year or two before he finished his PhD that he wanted to go work in sort of alternative energy policy and alternative energy startups and stuff like that. Completely switched fields, not really a researcher anymore. Using his expertise that he gained as a graduate student really well. And then there's other people who, the most famous thing for theoretical physicists is to go into like finance or consulting. So we know quite a few people who have done that. So there's a lot of different options that you can take. If you, I don't know if that's what you were asking about.
People who graduate from undergrad school like apply for jobs when they finish their study, right? Is the same for the physicists? They have to apply to institutes?
Oh yeah. So you would apply to postdoctoral positions in most areas of physics. The normal thing, if you want to stay as a researcher, the most common thing is to apply for postdoctoral positions, which is a sort of usually 2 to 3 year type of research appointment. If you wanted to go into another field, then you would apply for jobs in whatever sector you want to go to. And then, you keep applying for a while.
How easy or difficult is it to actually get a job at this business?
Depends on what you're studying.
Yeah.
Depends on what you do.
Depends hugely on what you do.
Powerful businesses.
It's not totally straightforward. I'm not going to say it's not easy, but.
And the other thing is it changes from one generation to another. So for example, there's like a really well-respected particle physicist that's, I'm not sure how many years, quite a few years older than us. But it's sort of one of the idols of our generation who had probably spent 9 years in different postdocs before he eventually got a faculty offer. That's a pretty long time compared to, in our generation, a lot of people that we knew were either getting faculty positions after 3 years as postdocs, or a few cases even less time, or they were deciding at that point, hey, I want to go do something else. And that's the other thing, is a lot of people might feel like, I'll give it a try, new research, but there are a lot of other things that I've enjoyed doing with life too. And after one postdoc, maybe they decide to do those other things. I think if you're, the best career advice that I ever got as after grad school was, you'll do better physics if you don't worry about your career. and I think that's largely true.
I think this applies to a lot of things.
Yeah. If you're focused, obviously you can't be like oblivious and not apply for your next job, right? That's not what anybody needs. But if you're guided by asking interesting questions and trying to do your research, and that's really what you want to do, I think there's lots of ways to find a position where you can do that.
I'm just wondering if you get into an institute like this one, how much freedom is there to go about your own way? Is there someone who says, okay, what have you been doing for the past 6 months?
Oh, well, so at PI, PI prides itself on trying to bring people to the institute at all levels, faculty, postdocs, the master's program we have here. And the whole point is to help foster and support looking in new directions, okay? Because there's a lot of things, building new directions, that's basically what PI is about. And then making progress in existing exciting directions, this is what PI is about. So it's never, nobody comes here that's told what to do. Of course, we're not idiots about it. So of course, within PI, we all, we have reviews, we scrutinize each other's work, we try to make suggestions. But that's, of course, part of it. But we've, total freedom.
wondering, while in university, did you ever doubt becoming a physicist, or at what point did you were you pretty certain that you wanted to enter the field? And I guess I was also kind of curious, you mentioned before that sometimes people go into other fields after getting their PhD, and I guess what were the most common factors that led to people wanting to leave the field?
Well, so do you want to answer that?
Okay, so the first question was, what again?
No.
Oh, when did I know? Let's see. And did I have any doubts? I had doubts after I knew. So I sort of, I think by my second or third year of undergrad, I was like, this is really cool. I'm enjoying it a lot. I want to learn more physics. I'm going to go to grad school. You know, I liked the, I had done a couple of research projects. I enjoyed it. I felt like, you know, if I can actually pull this off, this is the coolest way that I could spend my life ever. And then my second year of grad school, I got cold feet. And I was, one of the things that prompted it was I was, I don't know, my research projects weren't going that well. I started thinking like, gee, what else would I like to do? And then I looked at the applications for other PhD programs. So I was like, okay, what if I wanted to do a PhD in something else? And they all say, like, don't apply or you're not eligible for grants or something or other. I don't even remember if you already have a PhD. So I'm like, shit. You know, I do this, but I'm really excited about it. But it's closed off a bunch of doors for me if I ever decide to go back. Which, by the way, I'm sure that there are ways around it. Okay, but that was just my little panic moment. And, you know, and I thought about maybe I wanted to, like, maybe it would be fun to like engineer a Mars rover or something. I mean, I was definitely still thinking about technical fields because that's where my interests were. But I was like, you know, what if I don't want to do particle physics research all the time? And I talked a little bit with my advisor about it. He sort of didn't want to talk to me about it, but he said, whatever, it's fine to have your doubts. Just, you know, take your time, figure out what you want to do. He definitely didn't want to be like a counselor. It's probably the right call. I talked to him about it. We were dating. He was like, you know, we're in a really exciting time in our field right now. Let's just take this a few years at a time. And at least what I would do, I'm not sure I want to do it forever, is what he told me, but I'm going to take it a few years at a time. And, you know, the LHC could be really exciting. Let's see what comes out. And we can always quit and do something else after that.
Yeah, just in general.
This is how I always squelch my doubts. Maybe this is healthy, maybe it's unhealthy, I don't know. Is saying that, but I mean, if you like what you're doing, it is worth remembering that you can always do something else later. When you like, if you're worried about liking it less in the future, you can kind of change things up in the future when you're liking it less. So I just sort of stopped overanalyzing it. And every couple of years I asked myself, I still want to be doing this, and so far, every couple of years, I've answered yes, so here I am.
What was your second question? I completely forget.
Oh, why did people leave physics?
Oh, why? Oh. Well, just because they decide something.
Yeah, but
sometimes people have, you know, sometimes there's, you know, they'll be in a relationship that would be long distance, you know, and so for various sort of, you know, two-body reasons, relationship reasons, they might switch fields, sort of make things easier, or maybe they have little kids. You know, and there's family reasons. There's a lot of reasons, there's a lot of situations like that, to the best of my knowledge. There's also people who just decide, there's something else I'm interested in more, and an opportunity popped up, and I don't want to lose it, so let me leave. You know,
sometimes
so,
people just find that, like, actually, the sort of existential void that you're in when you're doing research is kind of uncomfortable. Like, and I mean, it is uncomfortable for us, too, but we... That you sort of, you know, you don't know whether you're asking a relevant question, whether you're making progress, whether your research will actually amount to any contribution to humanity after you're gone. I mean, obviously lots of us have these doubts in any area, right? But it's certainly there in science. And some people just decide, you know, that's uncomfortable. I want to just have a job where I have well-defined responsibilities, and if I do those responsibilities well, I do well, and if I don't, I do badly, and not have this sort of, you know, this big open question that even if I'm really clever and have really good ideas, they can still be wrong. and I'll have just, you know, had wrong ideas with my life. Or, and in some fields, more than others, they're really demanding lab schedules. So, for example, experimentalists that I know who have to take midnight shifts on their experiments. And that's just part of the job. And it's, you know, it's part of the job for a long time.
Well, their experiments are in Europe,
experiment.
And their families are in North America.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is...
So, like, there's a lot of just, there's a lot of work-life balance reasons that sometimes work for some people and not for others, and you just need to see how that goes for you. And sometimes it's just, you know, wanting to do something different with their lives, having different goals.
Okay, so when you are studying a question, will you pursue it, like, will you stay up late and try to work it out? Or you all take a rest? Like, do you value, how do you value rest? And also, where do you do most of the thinking? Do you prefer to think alone, or do you prefer to have some social interaction? Does it help?
Those are both really good questions, and my answer to both is some of each. So, I mean, I think there's, yeah, well, you have firmer answers, so why don't you take it?
We'll probably answer this very quickly. So.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's different ways of being stuck. There's different ways of getting out of it, depending on exactly how you're stuck. So sometimes I hit a question where I'm just like, I don't know what to calculate next. How can I make any progress on this problem? And for that, what I find I need to do is just pick something related and work through it. And, you know, even if that calculation isn't very useful, it doesn't really sort of teach me what I wanted to learn, it's taught me a little bit about how to work with that problem, what angles to look at next. And it's just the most important thing I can do those days is when I get into the office in the morning, just calculate something. Sometimes there's like a more conceptual question, or I'm just trying to sort of look for an idea. For that, and that's, by the way, that's a very solitary process. If it's like, I need to find an idea, then often talking about possible ideas with other people is good, just because, you know, two people have more ideas than one, and two people will shoot down the bad ideas among them a lot faster than one person would. Actually, that second thing I think is a lot more important. Having like one more person with you, because when you have an idea, you're sort of invested in wanting it to work. And another person who's less invested in it might be able to tell you quickly why it doesn't make sense. And then you move on to the next thing.
Yeah, your worst enemy is yourself. It's useful to have other people around to pop your pop your bubbles, you know, so that you kind of stay grounded. I am a super obsessive person, so when I get stuck on a problem, I'll you know, I won't eat. I don't think that's terribly healthy, but I can't help it.
Whereas I'm a poor sleeper. I need like my 8 or 9 hours of sleep every day, and usually I still don't feel rested. I didn't used to be like that, but I am now. So, yeah. So I usually sleep on my problems just because I need to get my sleep. Otherwise, I'll be someone nobody wants to be around, including myself.
Last year, I think, Philip, you were just putting out a paper or something. I saw you wandering around, and you looked miserable. You were just... I just thought, I talked to you about this, and you said, yeah, I was just about to do a paper or something like that, so I was probably really just kind of confused just before it all comes together. And so it's very much like that. You see these guys in the building, and it's like you kind of, you start to recognize and say, okay, just leave them alone. They're in their zone.
Sorry about that.
So just kind of back to like not knowing what you want to do. So like I gather from what you said that like if you were in physics, it'd be kind of relatively easy to switch into a more technical field. But say you started off by taking just like a pure math degree or an engineering degree, how easy to then switch into theoretical or even experimental physics?
I'm not sure because I haven't done either. I know a couple of theoretical physicists who have engineering backgrounds. I learned recently that Persichetti was an engineer in undergraduate school, and then went on to do theoretical physics. And a lot of these cases, well, Paul Dirac is another famous example, although he really hated boarding school quite a far way from but yeah, I mean,
it's been done. I don't think it's that common, but it's been done.
But it's not, I don't think it's so uncommon because it's impossibly hard. I think it's so uncommon because people usually figure out sort of more, well, we could just call it adiabatically, what they want to do, which basically means they're sort of, you know, weaving around. Like, if you start out as an engineering major in undergraduate, but you're really leaning more towards physics, you're probably going to have pursued that leaning a little bit already by the time you're graduating. And I mean, you should. If you have other interests, you should pursue them a little bit, at least early, just to sort of see how you like them.
Now, a lot of people who've done math and engineering, though, have gone into experimental physics. That's for sure. So I think your question was theoretical physics specifically.
And as for math, I mean, there's some people I know that, like, well, yeah, I know who do math that's very closely related to physics, but they're still in math departments, for example. So it really depends on, you know, people work it out in different ways.
What do you guys love the most about being a physicist? Like, what do you enjoy the
most? But I think, I mean, the main thing for me is just being able to ask these really cool questions and actually, like, contribute something, something to human knowledge. I mean, I don't want to sound like...
Yeah, we only figure out...
It's really hard to
right?
say this stuff without sounding really arrogant. Right? Because the ultimate goal of physics is just to understand nature, at least the kind of physics we do, it's just to understand nature better. Yeah, so Philip always likes to say, we only get to understand things once. And, like, every individual thing once. And so I mentioned it's kind of, there's kind of a queasy feeling about being in this limbo where you can't tell whether you're doing something right or wrong. I actually also find it kind of exciting. Just the possibility that I could be finding some, like, long overlooked but fundamental truth.
So if, for whatever reason, and there's many reasons, you go into physics, either experimental physics or theoretical physics, let me just say, it is really helpful to learn a little bit of the history of science, just the history of sort of discovery of technology, all of it. It brings a tremendous amount of perspective, because there's been lots of questions like, oh, you know, did you know you wanted to go into it? You know, when did it become decided? And you know, people leave the field. You know, how do you guide your? I mean, there's all these kinds of concerns, and they've always been there for forever. Like, and even absolutely fantastic physicists, you know, they've come in from totally different subjects in some cases, or they've had their own doubts, or they've had their own struggles, and it's you know, it's useful to look at that. So the reason I love physics is that I have no idea how this is all going to turn out. Okay, so it's a complete question mark. But the questions themselves are well posed. I mean, it's very clear there's phenomena out there that we just do not understand. Okay. Most of the universe, we don't understand it. And we're going to figure this out once. I'm hoping we figure this out in my lifetime. And I'm certainly trying pretty hard. I may fail, but I'm gonna give it a good shot. And I think all my colleagues sort of have the same feeling. You know, we're gonna give it our best shot. And we may completely waste our lives and make no progress. That's a possibility, but the process is exciting for sure.
Yeah. So how exactly is your job as a physicist? Like, you get into, like, the offices, you said, and what do you do? Calculate stuff all day? Or how does that even work?
So yeah, it depends from one day to another. And also from one physicist to another. So a lot of days, I'll come in, I'll sort of know what kind of general idea I want to develop, try to figure out whether it works or not. I'll calculate it. Or I'll talk to him or to one of the postdocs about something, and we'll be like, yeah, I'm confused about this, and both sort of think through it together out loud. And then you sort of find, like, it's like you find a path. So recently I went bushwhacking through the woods for the first time and sort of looking through animal trails. And it was really cool being in Alaska, but I think it's also a good metaphor for research. Because you're sort of looking for the trails. Like, you don't know where the trail is, but there probably are some there. You're sort of looking for the places where you can actually make progress. And then once you find it, you sort of chug along and see, you know, see what you can do. And you're like, okay, this is something interesting enough that I want to really sharpen it and write a paper about it. And so then you write a research paper, you sort of think through it really carefully, you try to, you know, you try to figure out whether there's other offshoot trails coming off of it that might be equally interesting or even more interesting. And you write about it, and then you usually go around and talk to colleagues at conferences around the world, talk to other colleagues by visiting other universities and giving seminars. And
I think it also depends on what's going on.
Yeah.
So for me, okay, I mean, if I'm finishing a paper, that's a very different than my days, you know, in some sense are very regimented. You know, I get up in the morning, I'm just trying to finish my work. So that's probably not so interesting. Then there's the days where you have an idea, there's calculations that you're trying to complete, and on those days, you know. Okay, so at least for me, you know, it's coffee, open computer, a bunch of emails, close computer, sit down, and then you just keep doing the calculation. It's like being, you know, that part's like being in school, actually, right? You have a sort of, it's the problems are not
it's
being
like
given to you. You've
assignments.
Created your own problems, right? But you just you're working on. Then there's the other part, which is, you know, you want to spend a reasonable fraction of your time doing this as a researcher. It's the days where you're trying to find, there's a bunch of questions you have, but you're trying, some of the questions are vague, some of the questions are precise, and you're trying to find the ones that you can make quantitative and precise enough that you can make progress, which at least for us often means finding a way to bring experiments there on it. Okay, so those days are all over the place. You know, for me personally, you know, I usually have my ideas like, oh, I wonder if such and such, you know, device is sensitive enough to such and such an effect that we were thinking about 3 months ago. That would be interesting, but I don't know. You know, I don't know if the answer's up or down. You know, and for me personally, I'll get those ideas typically in the morning, like within a half hour after I wake up, and then, you know, go in, and then it's sit down and try to estimate or calculate to see whether any of the ideas were correct. And that's, by the way, is where it's like fail, 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 fail. Most of the ideas don't pan out, right? So the day usually starts with failure. But then on a handful of days, there'll be one thing which is like, oh, you know, maybe that might work. And then that'll, you know, the lunchtime, we'll get together with the postdocs, or, you know, Natai and I will get together in one office, and then we'll talk through it in more detail, or we'll try to bounce ideas back and forth to develop it further, you know, and it continues into the afternoon. So those days are really exciting. They're really, oftentimes at the end of the day, you kill all the ideas you had at the beginning of the day or the day before, and then you're like, you just feel like a little demoralized, and okay, this won't go anywhere. But that's, it sort of really depends. Let's see, somebody hasn't asked a question. At least,
yeah.
How important would you say that, like, doing undergrad research, like, in the summer is, in terms of, like, figuring out which area of physics that you want to go into, or getting into a particular master's program, PhD?
I think that certainly my experience and the experience of a lot of people I knew who did research was that they found it really useful. And mainly for the first thing you said, figuring out what they like, whether it's a good fit for them. One of my friends wound up sort of doing thought he wanted to be a particle physicist because particle physics was badass. I don't know. and then he did a biophysics research project one year just to try something different. He did an MD PhD program after that, and it's like full, you know, most more bio than physics now. I did a sort of summer research program where there were three of us doing theory, and out of the three of us, I was like, this was fun, I like theory. And the other two were like, well, now I know I definitely don't want to do theory. So, small data sample of people that I know who have talked to me about it. My impression is that it has been really useful to people figuring out what they want to do. And it is really useful to sort of figure those things out as early as you can. Because if you know that there's particular sort of few of them or some particular set of areas that you think you're most likely to be interested in going into grad school, that will really affect what grad schools you really want to apply to and really want to go to. I think there's many areas where you think like, you know what the like USA US News and World Report rankings of the universities are, but it's really a lot of fields are driven by individuals in all kinds of different places, and if you know the more you know what you're interested in, the better you can find the people that are actually doing exciting work in those areas. So I think it's really helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if you had to convince us all not to take physics, what would you tell us?
And why?
I'm just wondering.
No, what are the things we don't like about?
I guess that's what I'm not sure.
No, I have never been asked the question that I'm waiting for. I've kind of already said a lot of these things. Like, if you want to pursue physics research as a career, then it's going to be a significant investment of your time. It's not a 9-to-5 job. Depending on the area, you might be forced to take midnight shifts on a regular basis until you're like 40. You might be, you'll have to move a lot whether you like it or not for your career, or you'll have to make career sacrifices to stay in the same place. It's a very demanding job, and that's fine if you really like it. If you don't really care for it, if it doesn't like really excite you, at least some mornings. Some mornings I'm not excited either. But if it doesn't at least excite, like, about what I'm going to do that day. But if it doesn't at least in the abstract excite you as something to spend your life on, then you probably shouldn't do research. Because it's just, it's intense. And if you're not excited about it, and you don't put your all into it, then you're less likely to do really awesome research. So that's one thing I might tell you to discourage you. And then the other thing is, obviously, if you know you don't want to do physics research, 2 years from now, don't spend 6 years finishing your physics degree and getting a physics PhD, and then try to go into, biotech. Unless there's a particular reason you think that's the right, that's the right direction to go for your goals.
I don't think there's anything actually, there's not that many things that are specific to physics that are reasons not to do physics. I think any given, whether it's research or whether it's financial investment, whether it's being a doctor, being any of these things, there's going to be elements which are, it's basically going to boil down to, if you want to be really excellent at it, you really want to make a contribution, it's going to require a lot of dedication, a lot of time. And so you better, so you should be excited about it. And if you're not excited, then maybe think about doing something else.
Also, another quick question. Alice or Bob?
Alice or Bob?
You're asking about the shark specifically, or?
No, just Alice or Bob.
What was the question?
I think you can say right. Alice plus Bob, and I can say Alice plus I times Bob.
Well, I was just pointing at you, but both of you can ask questions.
Okay. Because this is a weird question. But why did you choose research over being a professor and also researching?
Well, usually.
Are you doing both?
Okay, most of the researchers, or the North America, say, are employed in universities, and so you do your combination of teaching and research. That's a sort of, that's a very typical model. And then there's a few institutions, PI among them, that are definitely more, where the researchers who are employed are more directed at research. And of course, all of us here usually participate in teaching in our master's program, but it's a bit different than at university. It's very different than at university. So, you know, for me, I think it's a big privilege to be able to spend most of your time really focused on your research. So for me, I certainly consider it that.
Yeah.
But I didn't have like any sort of, you know, when I was going into it, I think I would have been fine teaching and doing research at the same time. I mean, these are not teaching in some respects can be useful for keeping your mind sharp.
Yeah, and it's probably worth also mentioning, like on the continuum. So PI is sort of further on the doing less teaching side, and then there's sort of research university professorships, and then there's professorships at four-year colleges that are more geared towards teaching, where most of the faculty there are doing good research too. But there's an even greater emphasis on teaching and on involving undergraduate students in your research. So there's a lot of ways to sort of combine the two. And I was probably most excited about the research side, although I enjoy teaching too. And then this was just a really fantastic institution where we were both able to go, and that sort of sealed the deal.
Yeah, we got very lucky.
It wasn't a matter of, oh, I'm gonna try to go to PI if I don't have to teach there. I never actually thought about it that way. I applied to university professor positions too, and I was happiest with this option at the end of the day for a whole bunch of reasons that were more to do with just the research environment here than anything else.
Thank you. Oh, many papers get published every month, every week, right? Oh, do you have to read every one of them in
order? No. I think at any given time, we're all actually pretty narrow specialists, which means, and I mentioned at any given time, and that's really important, because like I said, I've switched from one sort of specialty area to another. So in particle physics, we have this thing called the archive.
That's not just part.
Right. But it's
an internet page, right?
Yeah, it's an internet page, and just to give an idea of the scope, so in sort of theoretical particle physics, which is actually two directories of this webpage, FPH and MTH. So I guess 5 days a week they post articles, and there's usually about 20 to 30 articles on each of those two pages. So that's 50 articles a day in particle. And that's what we check rather than the journals, just because it's a lot easier. Two pages rather than.
You guys all visited the archive page.
A bunch of different archive.org.
Oh, I went in there and it totally scared me off because getting a PhD doesn't mean that I have to read everyone.
No. So I'll tell you what I do.
Well, I set my standards for
you.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I do and what I've done since I was a grad student. More or less every day, or at least a couple of times a week, I'll try to go on there and I'll check. You know, so if I'm doing it every day, I'll look at the last day's abstracts, all 50 of them. So what that means is I open up the web page, and you know, it's like when you're reading, you know, the newspaper. You don't click on every single article, right? So for this, you look at the title, you look at the authors, and if the title looks interesting, or you know the authors are really, really good or closely related to what you're doing, then you will read the abstract. You'll try to figure out, okay, what's the conclusion of this paper? And then if that's close enough to something that you're thinking about right then, you'll download the paper. And if that's close enough, and if it's not, but you sort of think it's interesting, you'll file away the result, try to remember who wrote the paper, and you know, maybe you'll come back to it in a year.
Or sometimes it'll be a very bold claim.
You'll
open up the paper.
And then you open it up, you try to understand what the main idea is a little better. You read the introduction, the conclusion. And then I'll do a sort of quick read of the papers. A couple of papers a week, I will do a sort of quick read where I really try to understand, like, what is the content of this paper? Are there any parts that I should really work through? The number of papers that I really, like, work through carefully at any given time that are new papers is actually really low. More often, I'm looking back at whatever papers happen to be relevant to a problem I'm thinking about, which will mean, you know.
So, you know, in practice, I think the way that we actually typically learn physics is not from reading the archive. The archive is a fantastic resource because all the papers with all these different topics that people have made progress on are there. You can look at them at any given time. That's great. But in practice, actually, we, you know, all of us will be sort of loosely paying attention to the archive. Every once in a while, we'll very carefully read papers because it'll look like there's some very sharp progress made at something we care about. Maybe we don't care about it, but it's, you know, fantastic progress on a subject that a lot of people will be working on. We'll typically invite people to give seminars, and the seminars are, in many respects, a much more useful way to learn about what's going on anyway, because, you know.
You get to ask questions, and they sort of focus on presenting the main idea, not the, you know, not the
Yeah, there's a format for writing, you know, there's writing scientific papers and there's giving scientific talks, and they're not the same thing. Talks
yeah.
are always better.
And most people write their papers, at least in part, for themselves, by which I mean that they're, like, writing down, you know, writing down enough stuff that they can understand why exactly they thought, you know, all the logic and sort of all the key results when they come back to it in a year or two.
So maybe this was already recommended to you, but yeah, I mean, if you're curious to know sort of what kinds of papers or topics, experimentalists, theorists in condensed matter, in high energy physics, in all sorts of subjects, just look at the archive, just look at some of the titles, some of the abstracts, you get a vague idea. I mean, it'll be a lot. I don't know how many of you have looked at archive.org.
I just put the link on our Facebook page, so if anybody's
okay.
wanting to look.
The other thing that you can do, because you were just saying seminars are usually better, is so all kinds of places have seminars, but Perimeter records them and puts them online. So you can go to person.org and, like, you know, search for a word or search by date and, like, listen to some seminars and, you know.
Yeah,
so
I'm not sure.
We usually listen to one or two seminars a week. Now, by the way, the seminar series, they're pretty technical. Like, if I went to a quantum information seminar, I would not understand most of it. So, you know.
And we have colloquia, though.
So there's a good chance you wouldn't either, unless you've done a lot of, you know, kind of studying on quantum information. We have colloquia, which are generally more accessible to, you know, to graduate students that don't have as much field-specific background. And I think they're sort of meant to be.
But that's something that actually
yeah, that's
I think
something
many of you
that's used that you'll understand some parts of it and at least the motivation and get a sense of what people are thinking about. So I think, you know, you might not get the same things out of it that a graduate student would get out of it, but you'd still get something out of listening to the colloquium series. So you can check some of those out.
I kind of have, like, two questions. The first one's kind of small. How often do you guys go to, like, conferences and stuff like that? And my second question is, like, how difficult is it to get a paper published? Like, if the person who's refereeing your paper really doesn't like it, does that automatically mean that it's not going to get published?
Okay, well, this is always fun. So the answer to the first question, I'll just... typically, particle physicists, this varies from field to field. We go to maybe order a dozen conferences, workshops a year, something like that. That's pretty difficult.
Well, you're also kind of traveling.
Yeah, that's...
other universities.
Okay, actually, strictly
yeah.
conferences and workshops, maybe that's more like three or four.
Or five. I mean, that also depends on your taste. Some people, I mean, I really love to travel, but I also find it overwhelming sometimes. So I like to try to keep big chunks of time when I'm just here thinking.
Well, yeah, traveling to conferences.
Yeah.
But on the publishing side of things, yeah, you know, there's of course a sociology to all of this. If you get a referee who does not like your, you know, your research program or your approach to a problem, yeah, you can have problems for sure.
Oh,
I know plenty of people who have, you know, that every if you ask any physicist, they'll be able to who's been in the field for a little while, they'll be able to tell you a war story where it's like, oh, where they submitted a paper and they got just this scathing referee report. Not just simply, I don't recommend this for publication, but an I don't recommend this for publication, and then a two-paragraph rant. Like, why it's awful.
Yeah.
Why, you know. Anyway,
and
so it's,
the rants are really helpful, actually, because then you write a letter to the editor. You appeal the process to the editor of the journal. And, you know, if the person had just said, I don't recommend this to the, for publication because I don't understand how they derived equation 15, then you sort of, you know, you're like, well, how do you appeal that? If they say, you know, your paper is scum, and they're like so angry that they get factual stuff wrong in the referee report, then you can appeal to the editor and say, look, you know, the referee, I'm appealing this decision. The referee is clearly biased against this kind of research. You know, similar papers to mine have been published in your journal before, and they don't understand the claims.
But I mean, the context for all of this, though, I mean, it's so first of all, this doesn't happen very often. But if you ask anybody who's been in the field for, I don't know, half a decade or a decade, they'll usually have one, at least one example. The only time that doesn't happen is if you're working on a subject that's really, really well established, and you're sort of, you know, you're kind of incrementally making progress, you know, almost. Then it's just recognized. It's a subject that exists, and if it's meaningful work, then it'll typically be published. Where this happens is there's people. I mean, we're among them. You know, you come up with a new approach to a problem that where it's not clear if it's going to pan out. Then personal judgment becomes more of an issue, and then, you know, then this occasionally happens. So within the particle physics community, this happens. You know, every once in a while, to people who are sometimes referred to as model builders, they'll build new models, theoretical models, to explain. You know, maybe they're explaining some anomaly, or maybe they're explaining some feature of the standard model in a different way, and then personal judgment is brought to bear on that. And that can be a very opinion-driven part.
Okay. So, like, the referee just happens to be somebody that knows you and has a personal vendetta against you, they could result in your paper not getting published?
Oh, yeah.
Well, but then you can sorry. That will result in your paper not being accepted.
Yeah, that journal, yeah.
So then
you can go to a different journal.
You can appeal to the editor. And say, like, you know, and explain why their recommendation is unreasonable.
But editors are usually there.
Well, I've had a successful appeal. In fact, it was a paper that was just judged as sort of not appropriate for the journal. Was the referee's response? And it actually wasn't very angry. They just argued,
this
isn't
like
right for the journal.
The subject matter might be better.
And we. Argued to the editor, actually, you know, and I looked at your description, and, you know, and it got reversed. And I think there might have even been other cases for me, too. Or you submit it to a different journal, you get another referee. As long as you're not enemies with every single person in the field, you know, that's not going to happen over and over again. And if there is significant, you know, new content in your paper, then, you know, then you will get it published. You might have to write more courteous emails than you'd like in the process, but the system basically works.
It doesn't happen often enough for anybody to ever really worry about it, that's for sure. And it only ever happens when you're writing a paper, which is like the first paper in a topic.
Oh.
In which case, a lot of referees just have no idea how to evaluate it. And then it's just a big, you know, opinion drill.
Oh, okay.
Who are your favorite physicists, historical physicists, and why?
We probably share one in common, for sure.
Well, go ahead. Are you talking about Faraday, or could
be other times? Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of admiration for Michael Faraday, for sure. In his case, it's for a number of reasons. You know, so he came from a very tough background. Okay, so he didn't. You know, it's not like he was handed opportunities. He really had to go out and develop them himself, and really push for it. And he was eventually lucky enough to work under a very famous chemist in England. But then he went on, and he did an incredible amount of completely pioneering work that at the time was. It was very reputable science, okay, and it was experimentally driven science. But his approach to problems, you know, at the time, a lot of the great theorists looked at it and said, this is, you know, and, you know, people valued the experimental results, but a lot of the ideas that he attributed sort of attached to those results, people discarded. But at the end of the day, a lot of his ideas were vindicated. So Faraday is one of the originators for an approach to describing physics, where instead of describing the interaction of particles using what's known as action at a distance, where essentially all you're doing is you're saying particle A acts on particle B with a force that has some potential that depends on distance. But it's a description where you're literally describing the phenomenon by saying a particle A exerts force on particle B with a given force law. And it can happen at a distance. That was kind of the paradigm at the time. But Faraday introduced this idea of trying to describe phenomenon using, especially in electromagnetism, using lines of force that you probably heard about. He had a very tough time. In fact, he was unsuccessful at attaching any sort of mathematical rigor to that idea. But that idea was picked up in the 1850s and 60s and developed by people like William Thomson, who later became Lord Kelvin, and then also Maxwell. But they were building off of ideas that originally came from him. So I have, look, from my point of view, that's the birth of really modern physics. Okay, I mean, if you ask what set of ideas and theories really revolutionized our way of life, it's that, and then probably thermodynamics, just because that was the, that was sort of the foundation on which we developed steam engines and other forms of engines. But, those two key ideas. Yeah, certainly it's in that case.
Yeah, I'll just say, I have a thing against, so I'm not going to answer this question because I have a thing against your ownership of science. I often go on tirades about it. I don't really feel like going on a tirade now. But basically, I think it's often that the people we worship as individual heroes of science are, usually great scientists, but it's all part of a much, much larger effort of putting things together. And actually, the example Philip just mentioned is a great one. We all know about Faraday and Maxwell and all these laws of electromagnetism were named after an individual, right? But if you actually look at the history of each one of these realizations, it's incredibly complicated. Faraday was building on previous results to be able to make extremely good batteries and do different kinds of measurements of how currents, electric currents and magnets are related. And then people like Thomson did a sort of partial mathematical reformulation of what Faraday did, Maxwell did more. Maxwell thought his equations were equivalent to equations that another German physicist that we've all forgotten about, Weber, had written down. His treatise on electromagnetism, he wrote that they were equivalent formulations. And it was a bunch of other guys we basically haven't heard of, people like Lodge, Heaviside, Fitzgerald.
You may have heard their names, but they're not exactly revered people.
Yeah. They were the ones that figured out Maxwell's equations and the versions that we write down, that we see in our textbooks today. So in general, the scientific activities that I respect most are people that have sort of found completely new questions to ask or new ways of thinking about some phenomenon that really simplify our understanding of it. But I try not to worship the individuals too much.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. This is awesome, so I have a lot of questions. I don't know if this will sound a little like random, but I'm pretty curious. Like, does physics affect the way that you view life?
Do you want to elaborate?
Well, okay, what do you mean?
Like, I don't know, like, do you kind of marvel at things a little more because you really know what's going on fundamentally? Or, I don't know, you look at something and that'll spring up one of the questions you'll work on later.
So I don't think it's the second one has ever happened for me, but certainly, like, there's all these, our universe is pretty amazing, right? And, like, just Earth is pretty amazing and all the creatures on it. And so one of the really curious things about nature is that there's all these numbers in our theories, right? It's not just, like, we have to put in all these numbers by hand. At least right now, we don't understand where they come from. The mass of, the mass of the proton comes from other numbers, but, like, we set those numbers in the theory in order to get the right measured mass of the proton, the right measured masses of other particles. And if you ask, if I change those numbers a little bit, what would happen to the structure of nature? Turns out it would change a whole lot. So, like, if you made the the mass of the Higgs particle a little bit larger, that would change the mass difference between the proton and the neutron. The mass difference, the neutron's a little heavier than the proton, which is good, because that means the neutron decays, the proton doesn't. The proton's stable, so we can start, we can make hydrogen, we can make, you know, bind, then you bind the neutrons onto the proton, that's stable, yeah, heavier is down. If you change that mass parameter a little bit, you could get either that the neutron gets much heavier, it decays really fast, and you can't form heavy isotopes at all.
Okay.
Or the proton gets heavier than the neutron, you can't form chemistry at all. So there's these really cool little things that have, you know, have been learned through physics. But there's these sort of really intricate cancellations in nature. And it doesn't seem like something where there could possibly be a, you know, in principle explanation that it just had to work that way. Like, there's something cool going on that makes all the cool stuff that we see possible. Yeah.
Apart from being interested enough, how do you know you're talented enough to become a professional, like, research physicist? Because learning physics is exciting, but some people just may not have, in, may not be brave enough or creative enough to come up with new ideas.
Well, yeah, don't worry about that. Like, don't worry about
just
this at this stage. Yeah, you gotta try. And you usually, you're never gonna know 100%. You're always gonna have doubts. I mean, depends on the kind of person you are, but I think most people have doubts.
Yeah.
But, you know, every once in a while, especially when you're having doubts, then you look back to see sort of what you've done, how many ideas you've had, you know, and you tend to critique yourself on your past successes. But it's never always clear.
Yeah, I mean, I almost didn't go into physics for largely for that reason. I was just intimidated by it. And I don't know, I was lucky. I won like a big, I mean, not to brag, but honestly, the only thing that convinced me that little old me was good enough to at least try to do research in physics was that I won like a national level science competition when I was in high school. Which is not to say that I didn't even, you know, even do the competition. He's in many ways a better researcher than me, I'd say, or at least seemed like comparably good. We won't fight. So I mean, you know, so I'm not trying to say like, you know, please do not take the message away that you have to succeed at that sort of thing to be a scientist. That's not what I'm saying at all. All I'm saying is that it is normal to have some anxiety about that. And like for me personally, that was the thing that pushed me over the edge of believing in myself. But I don't think you have to do that. You just have to take the leap and believe in yourself and see where you go.
Okay, so there's one point I want to make, which even at a professional level, people often forget. So there's a huge difference between being technically talented, being good at mathematics, being good at solving particular math problems, that sort of thing. There's that kind of skill. And that is completely 100% different from being a good scientist. They're not, these are just completely orthogonal axes. Okay? So you should never, ever judge your own ability to be a good scientist and to make contributions to understanding the universe based on very technical skill things.
Like
don't
how
do
fast
it.
You can solve a math problem,
okay?
Compared to your friend.
Because there's lots of physicists, you know, up-and-coming physicists, they'll be technically very talented, but they'll be kind of lousy scientists, and they don't make it. There's many people I know who came up, they didn't have great mathematics skills. They had, you know, but you have to have some, there's some threshold, right? They had just above threshold mathematics skills, but they were, you know, fairly creative, clever, they looked at things in different ways, and they've made a real contribution to the subject. Okay. So be careful, you know, don't be too harsh on yourself.
Yeah.
And be careful to separate this, because there tends to be, you know, kind of an equating of being hyper good at mathematics with being, you know, fantastic scientists. They're different.
Yeah, and you figure out what you're good at. You know, some people might be really good at more computational things and not so good at like the very formal stuff, or you know, very good at connecting with experiments, and, you know, not very good at like the more mathematical side of particle physics. And you can sort of, you know, you'll find your own strengths as you go.
There's people in our subject who are, you know, I mean, just widely respected and renowned not because of their technical talent or even because of, you know, well, not because of their technical talent, but literally because they were particularly good at asking interesting questions, questions that other people could then attack and make progress on. But they were the ones who found the right question to ask, right? That's something, you know, it's very hard to figure out if you're good at that, even at an early stage.
Are you guys able to join us for lunch?
Sure.
Yes, we will.
Excellent. It is now time for lunch. Let's say thank you.